This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. For the ancients, wine, beer, and loaves of bread, the staples of civilized life, were gifts from the gods. Not until the 19th century did we understand that the only thing between us and a planet with no alcoholic beverages and only flatbreads on the table was a fungus, yeast. We are joined now by Nicholas Money, the professor of botany at Miami University and the author of a new book, The Rise of Yeast, How the Sugar Fungus Shaped Civilization. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome to Cincinnati Edition. And did you bring beer, wine, or bread here? I don't see it.
I've got the tankard underneath the table here. So, yeah, I'll swig from that regularly.
This is just one of those very interesting concepts of, you know, how you sort of have put together a lot of science in this book, some of which I understood, some of which I didn't, and history. So this is fascinating.
Well, I'm glad you found something that was edifying.
You're not just take them off. So, you know, you mentioned in one part of the book that anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss regarded the invention of brewing as a symbol of the passage of humans from nature to culture. How did all that happen?
Yeah, so he recognized that this was a very important phase in our development as a species, that around 10,000 years ago, we gave up the nomadic lifestyle in favor of living in settlements, in small agricultural settlements. And the idea was that it takes a village to cultivate a vineyard or to run a brewery. And Lévi-Strauss was actually particularly interested in mead. He thought that an alcoholic beverage brewed from honey was perhaps the earliest contact that we had with fermented beverages. But in the book, I make the case probably that it was palm wine was probably the first thing that we were drinking in any significant quantities.
Which almost was occurring in nature without human intervention too much.
So probably actually the history of palm wine goes back much further. And indeed, there's archaeological evidence from places like Mozambique with stone tools that are over 105,000 years old that are speckled with little starch grains that came from the wine palm. So showing that early humans or perhaps related hominids were making some kind of palm wine long, long ago.
You make the point that for millennia, literally, people credited what happened to grape juice or in the brewing process for beer as something that the gods did. And that, you know, even once microscopes were invented and people could see what we now know as yeast, they didn't think it was causing these processes. They thought it was created by the processes.
That's right. It's remarkable, isn't it? So we went through sort of thousands of years of engaging in or enjoying the fruits of this seemingly miraculous process. But then, as you say, even after yeast was first seen, and it may have been actually seen right back in the 17th century by the first microscopists, but it really wasn't until the work of Pasteur and some of his colleagues in the middle of the 19th century that this causal link was established, that actually this was a living microorganism, a single-celled fungus that was actually chugging out alcohol in the presence of sugar.
You know, if alcohol is so central to human life and communities, you know, why haven't we evolved as human beings to develop some sort of genetic protection from drunkenness or alcoholism? And in fact, there are some people who have genetic tendencies towards alcoholism that's in their genes. So what's the role here? What's the advantage of actually having a propensity for alcohol?
So one thing that we have done, though, is that actually we have over millions of years, we've evolved better chemical mechanisms for actually dealing with alcohol, for breaking it down, because it's in otherwise this would be an extremely, potentially an extremely toxic substance to be imbibing. So we're better at it maybe than some of our ancestors, but you're absolutely right that it's also the cause of a great deal of misery. So it's quite a touchy subject, therefore, about why this genetic propensity for alcoholism should have been maintained over the course of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. So that's certainly an issue that I talk about in the book. I'm not sure how far we want to delve into that now.
I wouldn't have asked the question if I didn't want you to delve into it.
Well, one thing you can do is you can look at the way that other organisms act under the influence of alcohol. And some of the most beautiful experiments have been performed on fruit flies. And humans, from a biological perspective, are really just complicated fruit flies separated by
We've known that for a long time.
We're well aware of this, right? We're all flies, in essence. But if fruit flies are given access to alcohol, they become more promiscuous, they become more sexually aggressive. Male fruit flies that are spurned by female fruit flies will actually engage in same-sex mating, copulation. And we just see so many examples among so many similarities between the way that fruit flies act under the influence of high doses of alcohol and the way that many humans, present company accepted, act after too many adult beverages.
Well, so the point is that lowering inhibitions actually may influence humans to procreate more.
That's right.
And that's actually populating the village,
absolutely,
the community. So there is a linkage here. Now, shifting over from alcohol, there's been bread in some form on human tables or around campfires forever. But it's not the bread that most people, certainly most Americans, would recognize today. That's in one sense sort of almost relatively recent.
Yeah, so the bread certainly be eaten, unleavened bread, so bread that hasn't been puffed up with carbon dioxide produced by yeast, has certainly been around for a very, very long time. And it's been suggested that maybe the ancient Egyptians were the first who actually produced leavened loaves. And the connection there would have been that they were engaged in brewing beer, and that yeast would have been transferred from the brewery practices into bakeries that were close by, and then that would have been another example of a miraculous transformation with the dough expanding.
Yeah, the foam literally accidentally getting put over
exactly
into the dough.
Yeah.
So even into late medieval, early modern times, the bread that ordinary people ate was not necessarily leavened and not consistently leavened.
That's correct.
And much harder, more problematic than all of the fun breads that we think we've got, right?
That's right. And it would have been tough to eat. It may have been actually very healthful bread made from lots of raw ingredients, but yeah, wouldn't have been. That's a good way of putting it. It wouldn't have been consistently leavened.
Okay, I want to. We have a. Well, can you hear through there now? Okay, now we can hear. Okay, we were having a little technical problem, but I think we've solved it. And, but a lot of cultures don't have leavened bread, or they don't use leavened bread. They may know about it. They use flatbreads.
Absolutely, yeah.
And those are, if you look geographically, they sort of fall into certain big sections of the world. And what's that tell us about culture?
It's interesting if we look at religious practices too, that in different branches of the Christian faith, then we can think about the way that unleavened bread is used in the Anglican Church and in Catholic services. But if you look at the Eastern Orthodox Christian Church, then they actually use in their version of communion, they're actually using leavened bread.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you to put your headphones on. We do have a caller, and we're going to see if we can make this work. And David, thanks for calling in. I understand that you teach in this area. Is that correct?
That's correct. Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Money. I'm looking forward to seeing your book. One of my favorite aspects of microbiology is the history of microbiology, and especially the practical arts. And you probably covered in your book, but I thought it was interesting that the very first use of grains in terms of microbiology was to make beer, as I understand it, and that the leftover grains from making beer, somebody happened to put them on the fire and found that if you cooked them, it turned into something that was quite palatable that we now call bread. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, so actually Levi-Strauss actually addressed that too, this famous anthropologist from the work very active in the 1970s. And it's this whole model of beer first and bread afterwards. And that kind of connection that you're suggesting this. I mean, this is all hypothesis, but it might well have worked in that fashion.
Well, in the Middle Ages, literally referring to beer as liquid bread.
That's right.
Was very common. And the connection between the two from a historical point of view was definitely seen. One of the interesting things too about this, I mean, there's alcohol, there's beer, there's bread, wine, beer, bread. But all of this ultimately has a Cincinnati connection, which of course everything does, right? In the sense of the creation of the modern yeast industry and the role of the Fleischmann Company, Charles and Max Fleischmann, coming here. And people may still know the little yellow packets and may recognize the branding, but they may not know that it's connected to Cincinnati because it isn't locally owned.
Yeah, anymore. So it's a very rich and compelling connection that Charles Fleischmann and his brother Max were Jewish immigrants from Austria that came to the United States in the 19th century. And they arrived in New York, and then eventually they moved, within a short period of time, they moved to Cincinnati. And they established the first commercial yeast plant on the Ohio River in the community of Riverside. So that's now part of the city. And if you drive along River Road today, there's a baseball park out there, Riverside Park. And that was the site of the original yeast plant. So this was the place where the Fleischmanns were creating concentrated cakes of yeast for baking.
So that they could be sold to people in their homes. It wasn't just for bakers, commercial bakers.
That's right.
But home bakers and home brewers, I guess.
It was the first really consistent source of yeast that could be used for baking. And it revolutionized baking in this industry, and the Fleischmanns became fabulously wealthy through that process.
You know, and politically influential too, by the way.
Absolutely.
I might throw in. Today, you cite that the annual modern yeast industry is worth $3 billion and 2 million tons of yeast is produced worldwide.
So that number is an estimate of actually how much is – that's the direct value of the production of yeast in these – yeast plants. But if you look at the value of yeast globally in terms of what we do with it or what we do with yeast products, then that figure soars towards $1 trillion and maybe represents 5% of the U.S. economy.
Gee, this little single cell.
Absolutely incredible.
It's right. Now, people may be able to tell from your accent that you didn't grow up in Oxford, Ohio.
I grew up in Oxford.
Yes, but England across the pond,
different
right?
Oxford, that's true.
Well, I was there just about 2 years ago, and people were really trying to convince me that I had to try Marmite or Vegemite at breakfast. And what is that stuff?
It's probably the world's perfect food, this glorious confection. I say that with tongue in my cheek, or I should do. It was actually one of the first solid foods that I ate. as a child, semi-solid foods. So it's a thick black paste that's sold in little jars, and it's revered in the United Kingdom and also in places like Australia and New Zealand. And it was originally a byproduct of the brewing industry, and it's really yeast in its most pure form, yeast in its unadulterated form. And it's spread. You can put it on toast with butter and then put a thin layer of Marmite on it. But it's very, very salty and very, very distinctive flavor, and probably despised by most, or would be despised by most of the listeners this afternoon.
Well, actually, you're being very polite. I want to read from your book. You describe Marmite and Vegemite as thick slimes of yeast obtained from breweries and salted to create a spread that is shunned by most of humanity.
It's like that there's a Japanese food, natto, isn't there, which is the fermented bean curd that, unless you grow up in a Japanese household and enjoy this from a very young age, you're probably likely to be repulsed by it.
The other aspect of yeast and the other impact in the modern world is the transformation or the creation of massive amounts of corn ethanol used, taking corn products in the United States, creating ethanol and putting that in gasoline in order to stretch oil supplies, basically. And how did that develop? How old is that? And what are the implications of this?
So, I mean, the technology is quite old, and certainly in Brazil, for example, they've been using yeast to produce ethanol fuels for a very long period of time, although in Brazil they use sugar cane rather than
corn. Which you actually make an argument it's a better product to begin with.
It's a better product. The problem is that there's a great deal of land clearance that has to occur to grow massive amounts of this monoculture of sugar cane. So it's not an environmentally benign process by any means. And in this country, we've gone with corn ethanol, and maybe 10% of the fuel that we use is actually ethanol produced by yeast, which is impressive in itself if you just look at all the vehicles driving around Cincinnati and just considering that in part this transportation comes at the expense of yeast.
And what have been the implications of that in terms of environmental impact and use of land and whether this really makes sense?
Yeah, that's a very controversial issue. So certainly a lot of native grass or natural grassland has been cleared to grow corn ethanol, and we don't have to go very far from here before we find, you know, many, many square miles of genetically modified corn that's being grown specifically to produce ethanol. And the industry would claim that this is a good thing for the environment, that it's neutral in terms of the production of carbon dioxide, better than burning fossil fuels. But the problem with this is that agriculture is a very intensive process. We're putting on a lot of fertilizers, using pesticides and herbicides to grow this corn in the first place. So the jury's still out really about the value of this environmentally at this time of great concern and very sensible concern about the amount of carbon dioxide that we're flinging in the atmosphere.
We've talked about lots of good things, beer, wine, bread. Controversial or at least questionable use to create ethanol. But what about health questions? You have a whole chapter on, and everybody knows that there are such things as yeast infections. And trying to clarify, and on the other hand, there have been people who have tried to claim yeast could cure lots of things. So how would you parse all of that out?
Yeah, that's right. Well, one thing I should mention is that the same yeast that we used to produce bioethanol and for baking and brewing, is a source of half of the world's synthetic insulin. So a genetically modified yeast strains are used to produce insulin. So that's a very good thing. But there are many kinds of yeast. There are many different species of yeast, hundreds of different kinds, and some of those are actually disease-causing fungi that can attack the human body. And so that's the darker side of yeast biology, certainly.
And women particularly face yeast infections, right?
Absolutely.
And is that because it's a particular strain of yeast? Is that particularly, variety? Or is that just the same yeast we're talking about in other contexts has acted differently?
So it's a different yeast then. It's called Candida, and there are different species, but Candida albicans is the common one. But this is present on all of our bodies. The problem that women encounter is that when the bacteria in their bodies are damaged by taking antibiotics, for example, the whole of the microbiome is thrown out of whack, and then this gives yeast an opportunity to grow in much greater numbers, much greater density than it normally does. And that's really what's responsible for those unpleasant symptoms.
Well, I want to thank Dr. or Professor Nicholas Money, who is at Miami University, the author of Rise of Yeast, How Sugar Fungus Shapes Civilization. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. Selena Reeder is our assistant producer. Layla Shakui is our intern. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I am Dan Hurley. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on 91.7 WVXU.